Then the next section that they get into is the performance of the Shraddha, the rites. So for the devotees, then these are not overly emphasized. For the devotees, the main emphasis is that person who has left, then there is one feeds the devotees. And after feeding the devotees, then a plate is made for that person. And then after offering that person, then that is taken and put, you know, somewhere outside or that. And generally crows and others then will take that. But the regular performance on the monthly or yearly and this and that, that the devotees don't worry about. That's not an important element. So this whole section, as far as Shraddha goes, then doesn't have much significance for us. But there's a few things in just dealing with and respecting the Brahmins when one is feeding, which have some application of consideration when one is dealing at other times, feeding the devotees. So, one of them is that it's mentioning to better feed less persons. Means if you're trying to feed some, you know, it's one thing if you're just feeding all the devotees, but if you're specifically trying to please, like you have you're doing some program, then it's pointing out better to do a program of those who you can properly take care of. Rather than make a show, yes, you know, today I invited, you know, 100 devotees, and then all 100 devotees were not satisfied, then it's better to deal with how many you can actually deal with. This is supposed to be the grihastha inviting to his house. The temple is another thing. Easiest thing is these kind of facilities are just done, feed the devotees in the temple, you know, and like that. But it points out that for someone who's inviting to the house, then better to invite how many you can actually take care of than out of pride trying to bring more and then not doing a proper job of it. It mentions here is other aspects of things is generally in the family. The tradition is that the order in the when the children are there in marriage is that the there must be a proper going through of just whoever is the oldest. Generally, they would be the first ones to be married, then the next, then the next, then the next. Because otherwise, the tendency will be is that if there is some delay in the older person's marriage, especially amongst the girls, then everybody will be very interested in the younger and may neglect the older. So that's not considered at all proper. So if this rule is maintained, then everybody's very enthusiastic to see that the oldest girls or the oldest boys are also taken care of very nicely. They won't be neglected. And then after that, then the other ones. So the pressure is there. Because sometimes due to various situations, you may get where there is delay or where, you know, for some reason or not, there's not proper endeavor. So it's very important that the endeavor is made to see that the arrangements are there for the how you say, the growing members of the family as they grow up, but in order of how they're growing, you know, from the eldest down. So that's considered very proper. This is interesting. It mentions here that if offerings aren't made with two hands, because generally you see in India it's very common when they're performing offerings that they always offer something with two hands. Means if one hand's ringing the bell, that's busy, the other hand is doing. So both hands are being used for the offering. But if no bell is being rung, then generally you'll see that they'll use two hands or they'll be holding in one hand and touch the other hand somewhere, you know, at the wrist or at the elbow or someplace they will touch, or just both of them together. It says if both hands aren't being used, then the inimical asuras forcibly snatch away that food which is brought without being held with both hands. So when offerings are there, because generally the plate is shown with both hands, then all offerings are shown like this. Because if it's not, it's not considered respectful. Respect given with one hand is considered for shudras. Respect by cultured persons are given with two hands. Like we see the pranam mudra uses two hands. That way we're giving respect. But just where there's only one hand, that's considered not so properly respectful. So in that case, then the different, you know, demoniac persons, and they take away all these things. I didn't realize it was so long. The last point it makes in the chapter is let him daily partake of the vignasa and daily eat amrita. Vignasa is what remains from the meal of brahmana guests, and the remainder of the sacrifice is called amrita. Say anamrita pau means, so what is left over from the offerings to the deities, or offering and sacrifice, those remnants are called amrita, or nectar. And then, vignasana, or vighasa, that is what is left over, it means the remnants of the devotees. Like that. So this is now, last 286, thus all the ordinances relating to the five daily great sacrifices have been declared to you. Hear now the law for the manner of living fit for brahmanas. So now he's going to talk about how they will live themselves, the brahmanas. Because what was happening before is that the student graduated, then he became married, he gave the rules of the marriage, and that. Then it said that he must perform these sacrifices, these five great sacrifices. Then it went through and discussed those, and the final being the Shraddha, which is was very large. So now here chapters 4, text 1. Having dwelt with the teacher during the fourth part of a man's life, a brahmana shall live during the second quarter of his existence. Oh no, this is supposed to be the first part of a man's life. A brahmana shall live during the second quarter of his existence in his house after he has wedded a wife. A brahmana must seek a means of subsistence which either causes no or at least little pain to others, and live by that except in times of distress. In other words, a brahmana will always choose that way of living that is easiest and doesn't give any problem to others, or at least very minimal problem to others, unless there's a great disturbance, a great problem, like that. Whenever it says in times of distress, means there is no proper situation. Like Prabhupada mentions that a brahmana, he will always prefer to perform his brahminical duties. But if there's no facility for that, then he may take up the duties of a kshatriya or take up business of vaishya. But he will not accept service from others as a shudra. So when things are not ideal and one cannot perform one's normal duties, that is what is meant by distress. It means that there is some problem that you cannot perform duties properly. So in that way, then you might take up things that are more disturbing, you know. But otherwise, you always take something that is very simple. Text 3. For the purpose of gaining bare subsistence, let him accumulate property by following those irreproachable occupations which are prescribed for his nature without unduly fatiguing his body. He may subsist by rita, truth, amrita, nectar, or by mritya, death, and by pramrita, that which causes many deaths, or even by the mode called satyanrita, a mixture of truth and falsehood, but never by swavrita, a dog's mode of life. Swa means dog also. By rita, so this is the first, truth, shall be understood the gleaning of corn. And that means when after people have gone through and harvested their fields, whatever's left sitting around, you know, just going and collecting like that. Then by amrita, which is given unasked, means that's like the what is that? Rita, he just goes out what nobody wants, he collects. Then this amrita means which is not asked for. It's like the python sadhu. He's just doing what he's doing, and people know he's a sadhu, and they bring things. In other words, the Lord arranges that. Like when Madhavendra Puri was in Vrindavan, then he didn't go begging, he was just fasting. And then Gopal came up to him and said, you know, here's some milk for you. And he said, why are you bringing this milk? Madhavendrapuri asked. He says, well, in this village, it's, you know, nobody goes hungry here. That's the rule here. So therefore, I'm bringing you this milk. Like that. So that is amrita, what one has not asked for. Then by mritya, food obtained by begging. And agriculture is clear to be pramrita. Pramrita, which causes many deaths. Which means, you know, when you plow the field and so many bugs or other things may be killed, or worms, or, you know, like that. So it's just like we were discussing before, that in the house, that the broom, the mortar and pestle, all these things, and so many living entities may die. And so, therefore, unless the life is given for sacrifice, you know, for spiritual upliftment, chanting of the holy name, preaching, some way engaging in the Sankirtan mission, then one, how one will atone for that? Because for one's own life, so many others are losing theirs. They may be insignificant, just some germs and bacteria and other things like this. But still, the point is they are souls and they are embodied, and they have their right to live. So in this material world, it's been made in such a way that every living entity lives at the expense of someone else. It's just the way it is, you know. It's just how it works. So in this, therefore, one must purify one's existence by engaging in spiritual activities. So then here it's mentioned that then you know, by the agriculture, then so many of these living entities are killed. So generally a Brahmin himself won't take that as his main form of sustenance, but he can. Generally he'll go by he just collects what no one wants, or just what people give, or he begs. But if that's not there, then he can do farming. Then the next is, but trade and money lending are satyanrita. So that means of the vaishya activities, then the agriculture is considered will be higher than money lending or business, because in the agriculture the difficulty, you're plowing the fields and it's growing, but with the business and money lending, then so many tricks must be there, right? You don't have to trick the seeds that you put into the ground, or trick the dirt that you're dealing with, or the fertilizer. But in business, then you must say, someone says, you know, ask about the price, and they say, oh, for you, we're making no profit, Prabhupada mentioned. Is that the businessman will say that. Like you go into a store, you see in India, and you ask, how much does this cost? And you'll always notice that there is the delay in the answer. You know? For you, this much. So while he was saying for you, he was calculating how much he could get out of you. You know, okay, this is a poor Bengali guy and all this, unless I say the right price and I'll only make, you know, this, just the bare profit, then he'll just go to the next shop, you know. But then he sees, you know, some richer person, then he can ask a little more, especially if he says some things about how good it is. You know, he sees a Westerner, then, you know, he just adds five times the price onto that. You know, so like that. So that little gap is where they're working out how much they figure that they can get from you. And then if you don't like it, then they'll immediately change their mind, they'll drop it. Or, you know, like this. So there's so much, you know, so much art is there, the art of business. So then he can do that. Service is called svavriti, therefore he should avoid it. So that means he won't do that. He won't take service from others. He won't work in the service of others. So that's not, he avoids. Otherwise, then he has to compromise his position. And all these others is that there's no compromise. The simplest is nobody wants anything, and you just pick it up. You go to the market after people have left. You know, there's always a few grains sitting around, a few little this and that. You pick that up. You go to the fields, pick that up. You know, whatever's left, you just take that. You know, no one wants it. No one will care. No problem. Then, you know, or you subsist by what somebody brings you. That is fine. When you go begging, then it says, then that creates a little problem for others. That's why it says is best is occupation that doesn't give any problem for others or minimal. Because when you beg, then the other person, maybe they're happy to give, they're religious, they like to give in charity. Maybe they don't really like to, but they know they should. You know, or you go to some people and then they tell you to go away. Like this. So like that. These are the aspects. Okay. 7. He may either possess enough to fill a granary, which is, you know, granary would be, in the village you see these golas. They don't have these big silos like in the West. They're a thing made out of bamboo with thatched roofs and that. And they hold, you know, a decent amount. You can easily put in there enough for a year in a granary. So generally like this year you harvest and you put it in the granary. You put it in the gola. And then, you know, you use that during the year. And then next year, at the next harvest, and that goes in again. So that'll be for quite some time. Or a store filling a grain jar means that these grain jars, they'll hold, some of them will hold like 100 kilos of grain. These big, big clay pots, big pots like that. Or you may collect what suffices for 3 days. You can go beg or this or that or collect from the field. That enough for 3 days, and then for 3 days one doesn't have to collect. Or make no provision for tomorrow. 8. Moreover, amongst these four Brahmana householders, each later mentioned must be considered more distinguished, and through his virtue to have conquered the world more completely. So he arranges, he gets for the grain for the whole year, and then he doesn't have to worry. So in this way he's also conquered the world. Once he gets, and then he doesn't worry about it. You know, however big his granary is, for that much time he doesn't have to worry. He can just engage in his duties. But there is the satisfaction of knowing I have stock. You know, I'm set up. I've taken care of myself. So there is a little dependence upon one's own ability. Or he may keep some. He keeps a little stock, you know, that may last for, you know, some weeks, months, like that, or season, you know, 2 months, like this. He may keep that. So that means more dependence on the Lord is there, like that. But then as it goes down for 3 days, but then, who doesn't make any provision at all, he's the most dependent upon the Lord. So it says he's the most, has conquered the world more completely. Because just the detachment. So all of them have their good points. But the detachment is there more in the last. So in the Vedic culture, Prabhupada points out that the essential, most essential point of respect is that of detachment. Therefore, we see in the Varnas, the Brahmin is respected because of his detachment. And the Ashrams, the Sannyasa, is respected because of the detachment. So that's the most essential item, the detachment from the material nature. So detachment can only come if there's knowledge and practice. So this means they must be studied and all that. So the Brahmin is studied, therefore he's detached. The sannyasi, because of his study and experience, is detached. Therefore, that respect is given there. So this is the Prabhupada mentions one can tell one's advancement by gyan and by rag. How much you have understood of the philosophy, and by practicing it, how much you've become detached from the material world. Because then we know we're advancing. Then we know we're coming closer and closer to the point of Brahma-Bhuta, where we're completely off the bodily platform, we're completely situated on the understanding, I'm not this body. So, and then from there, naturally then, pure love of God can develop very nicely. Because full love for Krishna cannot develop if we have material attachment. means we can either be complete 100% attached to Krishna or 100% attached to material nature, or partially attached to Krishna and partially attached to material nature. But you cannot be fully attached to Krishna and attached to material nature, or fully attached to material nature and attached to Krishna. Means that it's one has to give up the material attachment to gain attachment for Krishna. So as we become 10% detached, that means we can become 10% attached to Krishna. Like that. So, yeah. One of these follows six occupations. Another subsists by three, one or two. But the fourth lives by the Brahma Sutra. Okay, six. One, two, three, four, five. Oh, I see. He who maintains himself by picking up grains and ears of corn must be always intent on the performance of the Agnihotra and constantly offer those istis only, which are prescribed for the days of the conjunction and opposition of the moon and for the solstices. Means one who is maintaining himself by subsisting by just gleaning the fields and picking up what people leave and no one wants, he must always be absorbed in sacrifice. Right? In other words, this occupation is given that there must be, how you say, it's not that one is lazy. One just goes out, collects a few things, and then just hangs out in the house. Such a person who is taking this detached lifestyle must be very much absorbed in sadhana, must be very much absorbed in the preaching mission. That is the purpose. Otherwise, why would he be given such an occupation that is, you know, so peaceful for the mind and so simple, right? Otherwise, with that intelligence and qualification, then he should be doing something more practical for the people, right? Your Brahmins are studying, they're teaching, they're performing sacrifice like this. The Kshatriyas are overseeing the country, seeing that our facilities are there for everybody nicely. Then the Vaishya is creating the economic development by which everybody else is being maintained. And the Shudra is assisting the other three. So then it works very nice. So you have to be doing something for somebody. You can't just be able-bodied, intelligent, and then just have a simple occupation and do nothing. That won't be allowed. Everyone must be busy. Everyone must do something for the overall social body. Says, let him never, for the sake of subsistence, follow the ways of the world. Let him live the pure, straightforward, honest life of a brahmana. He who desires happiness must strive after a perfectly contented disposition and control himself, for happiness has contentment for its root. The root of unhappiness is the contrary. So happiness is only when there's peace. Krishna mentioned the Gita. How can there be happiness without peace? And peace only comes when there is control of the senses. When material desire is controlled, then the mind is peaceful. And when the mind is peaceful, one is happy. But if there's too much desire, then there's anxiety. And full happiness cannot be there. Therefore, you have this whole thing of entertainment. Why does entertainment have to be there? If you're doing something you like, you don't have to be entertained. Right? Like if somebody likes doing a particular activity, then he does not have to be entertained. That activity itself is satisfying to him, and he's happy. But because of anxiety of trying to fulfill material desires, all that anxiety we have to balance some way. Therefore, entertainment must be there. Right? Like the king has so much anxiety on his head for the whole country. Therefore, in the evening, then he'll sit with friends, have nice food, you know, hear nice music or see dramas or something to take his mind off of the anxieties of running the kingdom. Then he can become peaceful and satisfied. then the next day he'll be able to perform his activities very nicely. So many anxieties are there. Business. People into business, they just think about business all day, all night. Good businessmen are always absorbed in this. They put in 14, 16 hours a day. They're not just, spending 3 hours a day and expecting the business is going to flourish. They're always absorbed in that. So much anxiety is there. So then when they have the opportunity, little money is there, then they always have some big feast, some big festival, something, invite over relatives, laugh, joke, this, that, and then it relieves them of the anxiety of that. So these are there. But we see the Brahmin, he's doing something he likes, studying the scriptures, this and that. Then it's nice. Just like something is happening, mind is disturbed, then what do we want to do? We want to go someplace, sit down, read a little bit, chant our rounds, do something simple like that. So the Brahmin is given that as an occupation. Therefore, he's supposed to keep his mind peaceful. Otherwise, then it will be there'll be an anxiety. Right? A Brahmana who is a snataka, that means one who has graduated, and subsists by one of the above mentioned modes of life, must discharge the following duties which secure heavenly bliss, long life, and fame. Let him untired perform daily the rites prescribed for him in the Veda. For he who performs those according to his ability attains to the highest state. So Krishna mentions in the Gita that we should perform our own duty, our prescribed duty. Like Arjuna wanted to go off to the forest and figured he will perfect his life this way. And then Krishna points out, no, you're supposed to perfect your life doing your duties as a kshatriya. Means the perfection that is available for a Brahmin doing his duties is available for a kshatriya doing his, or a Vaishya doing his, or a Shudra doing theirs. Whatever. Everybody, whatever their position, if they perform their duties properly for Krishna's satisfaction, then they all have the same opportunity to perfect their life. It's not that one is more or less than the other. Like that. But the point comes is if one can do it in a detached way, then that is the proper. So if one is not a devotee, then the conditioned nature is going to overwhelm one. But if one is a devotee, then one is in control of the conditioned nature. He engages the conditioned nature in Krishna's service. So it's a very different state. So the devotee sees, I have this nature, I can perform these activities, I'm situated best in this particular ashram. And that way then I please Krishna with my activities. While the non-devotee, they're trying to please themselves with these activities. Whatever, the satisfaction, even the Brahmin, this is satisfaction, he's good, virtuous, he's learned, that's respectable. He just feels good, I'm doing my duties properly, he's satisfied in that. But the devotee is not looking for that, he's looking for Krishna's satisfaction. So by pleasing Krishna by performance of these duties, then it goes very, very nicely. Whether he be rich or even in distress, let him not seek wealth through pursuits to which men strive, nor by forbidden occupations, nor let him accept presents from any giver, whosoever he may be. Let him not, out of desire for enjoyments, attach himself to any sensual pleasures, and let him carefully obviate an excessive attachment to them by reflecting on their worthiness in his heart. In other words, the Brahmin should not perform occupational duties that others do to make themselves very well situated. Like that. He'll just do something that maintains himself. Therefore, the Brahmins are so dear to Krishna. Because they're very gentle in their outlook, and they're not overly trying to enjoy the senses, and not overly trying to engage in the material activities. Therefore, they're dear to Krishna. That's why he says. And they're giving very, very wonderful service. and the cows, then they are very gentle, innocent creatures. They give milk, which is perfect for religious development. Develops the finer brain tissues so one can understand the finer points of the philosophy. So like this, then one... Yeah. And he should not attach himself to sensual pleasures. And those sensual pleasures that he does have to deal with, he should reflect on them. What is their worth? If they're worth or not worth. You must be always observative of what is going on, what is happening. The Brahman means he is interested in understanding what is around him. He's observant. He's able to see. He can observe what others are doing. He can observe what he is doing. Right? Kshatriya may be very expert at observing what others are doing and seeing that the proper discipline and coordination is going on, but sometimes he has difficulty seeing himself. Therefore, the Brahmins are there to help. But the Brahmin is able to see himself. So that is why the devotee, he can actually go through the process of anartha nivritti. Because having taken up the brahminical consciousness of service to Krishna, or devotee of Krishna, then he is able to observe his own qualities. What is good, what is useful, what is bad, what must be removed. And he can see, you know, in a detached way, free from the ego, just what is the proper behavior. Like that. This is important, that the Brahman is able to do that. Otherwise, training is not complete. Training means the idea of going to the Gurukul is so that they learn how to distinguish between specifically the five levels of consciousness. And by seeing that five levels of consciousness, you can see all the activities that anyone performs. You can see how they perform their activities, why they're performing their activities. So this is a very important aspect to see. Let him avoid all means of acquiring wealth which impede the study of the Veda. Let him maintain himself anyhow, but study, because that devotion to the Veda secures the realization of his aims. It's by studying the Veda then you actually understand what is the actual goal in life. By understanding the philosophy, one understands what is the proper goal. And it's by having that knowledge, Krishna mentions that performance of prescribed duties, besides being detached, must be in knowledge. So without knowledge, how one will be detached? One may think one's detached, one may be attached in so many ways. You know, one thinks, I am doing this. But Krishna points out, you're not doing this. You're desiring to do this, Krishna is sanctioning it, and the modes are carrying it out. You want to do something. You want to move. We're not doing, because it's so nicely working that the combination between the Lord and the external energy, that they are just working and fulfilling the desire of the living entity. The living entity actually then develops false ego that he thinks he is the one who is doing. Because I thought, I will scratch my head. And it happens. Right? So he thinks, yes, whatever I want to do, I'm doing, I get. But we see sometimes we are sick. We want to move, we can't move. Because it hasn't been sanctioned by Krishna, and the modes of nature are not carrying it out. So Krishna points out, even opening and closing of the eyes, the modes of nature are doing it. They are taking care of it. So with knowledge, then one can see this. Otherwise, then it can become sentimental. We're performing our prescribed duties, but without the philosophy, then it becomes sentimental. So we want to be very careful to see that we have the knowledge. So therefore, the Brahmin should perform his activities, his occupational duties, but not at the expense of not being able to study or perform his proper duties. In other words, we may have to do some activities, but that should not stop our chanting, our reading, our somehow associating with devotees, engaging in some way in the preaching mission, worship of the deities, you know, worship of the Dhamma. These things should not be obstructed. You know, we may have to do them less. That is the meaning. Brahmachari means his duty is to study full time. The grihastha means there will be the prescribed duties, taking care of the wife and the family and all these different things that are there. So that he must find that balance. But he should not overabsorb himself where he is unable to take care of his proper sadhana and study in that. Let him walk here on the earth, bringing his dress, speech, and thoughts to a conformity with his age, his occupation, his wealth, his sacred learning, and his race. In other words, no one should see that one is not dressed or behaving properly. It should be according to one's, he says here, his dress, speech, and thoughts. So he should think in accordance of what he can actually do, what is his position. He should dress according to that. You know, he should speak according to that. He shouldn't speak the yes, you know, very lofty when he's not very well educated. Or dress very fancy if he's not, you know, wealthy. Like this. So he should always keep everything in conformity to his age, his position, and everything what it is. In other words, people should be very satisfied with how one is dealing. 19. Let him daily pore over those institutes of science which soon give increase of wisdom, those which teach the acquisition of wealth, those which are beneficial for the worldly concerns, and likewise over the nigamas which explain the Veda. For the more a man completely studies the institutes of science, the more he fully understands them, and his great learning shines brightly. So, in other words, it says, which quickly gives the results, soon gives increase of wisdom. Means, one, this is the best, of course, is the transcendental literature. So that is what one should be studying. But along with this, it says those aspects of the Vedas, those institutes of science, means that everyone has their nature. So let us say someone has a nature for music. He will study those aspects of the Vedic sciences that deal with the music. Because then, because it's his nature, he can understand them quickly, he can apply them, and he can train others in them. Well, if he takes a branch, let's say he's very interested in logic, but he doesn't have that kind of intelligence, he may spend years and years and years trying to gain something. Nothing's really gained. Neither he is benefited, nor, as a Brahmin, can he benefit anyone else. So what is his own nature, he must see and study those sciences. And then he's able to use those and teach those to others. So the nature must also be seen. So it's pointing out here, the Brahmin must understand what is this nature. So it says acquisition of wealth, meaning that one there is how you say result from it. We're interested in spiritual wealth, so one gets spiritual wealth by service. So one should be doing a service. Like Arjuna wanted to go to the forest. That's a bona fide occupation. But it was not his nature. So there would be no gain for him, no gain spiritually or even materially for him by doing that. Because it would not be in accordance with his nature. So the Brahmin, according to his nature, then studies those things which will then he'll be able to use properly in the Lord's service. And by that service, wealth is gained. But otherwise, unless one can perform something practical, then what is the use? Like that, studying just to study, that's sense gratification. Here, he's always saying that one must study, one must do, but that is because that is the duty. He must study because he must teach others. And so unless you know how you'll study, how you'll teach, so he must learn this way. And he says, likewise over the nigamas which explain the Veda. So the fine points, those who exhibit the essence. Right? Like the Bhagavatam. What is that? Nigama kalpataru galitam palam. You know? It means gives the essence. You know? The Siddhanta, those that give the conclusions. So one should study the sciences that are, but he must also know what are the conclusions and how they connect. Otherwise, what's the use? You may be very expert in a branch of knowledge, but unless you know how that connects to Krishna, how to practically apply that in Krishna's service, then it's maybe pious, but it's not spiritual. Only when you connect it to Krishna does it become spiritual. So that's what we're interested in. We're interested in spiritual connection. Piety. So, see, in the Veda, talks about pious and impious. That's the place where it comes off into this science. Krishna has created the whole world, and he has created what is right and wrong. So up to this point, we've dealt with Krishna. Then the books on right and wrong then are explained. So now one can look at right and wrong in two ways. One is that which means what is impious is wrong, and what is pious is correct. But then there's another way of looking, which is the actual transcendental way, is what is in connection with Krishna, that is pious, and what is not in connection with Krishna, that is impious. Even if it's materially pious, it's spiritually impious. So we're looking for spiritual piety. So whenever here it uses the word wealth, piety, you know, heavenly piety, all these means we will understand it means what is connected in relation to Krishna. I mean, in other words, the spiritual wealth, spiritual piety means of service to Krishna. And the materialist, they'll read it and think, oh, very nice, heavenly planets, or going to the Brahman, or like this. So in other words, this is why Vyasadeva was not fully satisfied. Because he's written all these nice scriptures, and they all are just talking about Krishna, nothing else. Right? Prabhupada points out that in the Vedas, the only purpose is always remember Krishna, never forget. And every rule that's there is in support of this. So that means every rule that is given is only for either remembering Krishna or not forgetting it. Right? So those things that attract us to the material world make us forget. So how to detach ourselves from the material world. And knowledge about Krishna and his name, form, qualities, and pastimes, and his wonderful relationships with his devotees, that attracts us to Krishna. So there are things that detach us from the material world and what attract us to Krishna. So that is always remember Krishna, become attracted to him. Never forget him, never become distracted by the material world. So that is there. And Lord Chaitanya says that there's only three things described in the Veda. Sambandha, or relationship between the living entity and the Lord and the material nature. You know? In other words, understanding we're servant of Krishna and not servant of this material nature. Then Abhideya, the process of serving the Lord, and Prayojana, developing pure love for God. So this must be taken as authoritative. So that is what's being described here. But because there are people who are willing to be materially pious but not spiritually pious, therefore the spiritually pious activities are written in a way that the person who is interested in material piety also becomes enthused. right? Like you see, if you get a group of people who are interested in a particular thing, they have a particular vocabulary, right? Whatever they're interested in, they have their vocabulary. And if you talk their vocabulary, they become very enlightened. And if you don't use their vocabulary, they're not so interested. They have their own vocabulary for what they deal with. They may even have different words for something that's commonly, it's just like we'll call it a car or an automobile or something. The people, they're into it, then they may call my wheels or whatever, that they call it nowadays, like that. So it's like, and you just call it, get in the car. It's very ordinary for them. Or you say your automobile, and they think, they crack up. Who's this guy? Is he from the last millennium or what? So then, but you talk in their language, and then they're very enlivened. So in the same way, the materialists, there's certain words that they're very, very much, they tune into immediately. Profit, wealth, enjoyment, happiness, like this, satisfaction, all these things. Immediately, that's what they want. They don't know that the only way you can get it is through Krishna consciousness. By becoming detached from the material world and attached to Krishna, that's the only way you can become satisfied. But because that's what they want, you write it in such a way that at least they're performing the activities that are recommended. And so And because the purpose is to serve Krishna. If they're not serving Krishna, then they're responding because then they think they are the doer. Means if you're serving Krishna, then at least acknowledge Krishna is the ultimate doer. If not, he's the one who's actually running things. I'm not the doer at all. Right? Or I may think I'm the doer, but Krishna is the ultimate doer. So I've done this activity, I get the result. So it's my result, but then I give it to Krishna. That's sakam. Nishkam is you understand Krishna is the doer, and so whatever results come from an activity that we may perform, that is coming from Krishna. He is giving it. It's not us. So it's automatically Krishna's. So the materialist thinks he's the doer, and therefore the reactions come to him. And he's not connecting himself to Krishna, so there's nothing actually to properly purify himself. And because he thinks he is the doer and all these, takes the responsibility, so then so many extra little rules are made for them that are based on the eternal principles. Right? There's still respect, cleanliness, all these different things. Like it went through this whole thing in the Shraddha rites, and there's about three pages or four pages of who you don't invite to the Shraddha rite to feed. So anybody that has any discrepancy in their lifestyle or their mentality or they're not properly trained, none of them you, because the forefathers don't want to accept anything through such unqualified people. They only want to accept something through someone qualified. Therefore, so many rules are given. So the point of being qualified, being pure, having knowledge, properly following the culture, even in these very materialistic activities, taking care of the forefathers, because then they'll be benefited, and then because you do it, then your son will do it for you, and then you'll enjoy on Pitri Loka, like this. Or, activities, you're going to heavenly planets, so therefore, because you've done a whole life of piety, you want to make sure that when you go to see Yamaraj, get the results of your pious activities, that you don't have any difficulty getting to his place, right? Because he stays on the other side of the Vaitarani River. And this Vaitarani River, that if you're not proper, if you don't do the right things, it can be a nightmare for you. So therefore, then they'll give a cow in charity at a certain time, just before their death, just so that they get across that river very nicely, right? But for the devotee, because he worships Krishna, he doesn't have to bother with Yamaraj. He's not going there. It means we bother with Yamaraj as a Mahajan. We take his instructions. but we don't have to go to him for receiving pious activities because we're not interested in pious activities. Right? So for those who are absorbed in the material world, then all these little details are given, though they're based on the Vedic principles of higher realms of, you know, respect of authority, cleanliness, control of the senses, all these things are there. But they're written in such a way that that person who is materialistic has to follow them, otherwise then they get a bad reaction. You know, they're forced to be pure and all these things. It means the devotee is being pure because it pleases Krishna. Unless he becomes pure, how he'll develop love for Krishna? But the materialist is not interested in that. He's just interested in his own sense gratification. So he'll degrade himself. So therefore you point out, well, if you do this and you're very clean, then you'll go to the heavenly planets, you'll enjoy so much. But if you don't do this, you'll go to hell. And this is, so many nice hells are there. You know, you want, like, we have this nice, one of them is a nice big copper plate as far as you can see. And on the top is the sun, right? There's no trees, nothing, just a copper plate, right? Copper gets hot real easily, like that. And then from the bottom, you know, the Yamadutas are there stoking up a nice fire, right? So there's no relief. You can't, if you stand, your feet burn, you know, you sit, you know, your backside burns, you lay down, everything burns, you stand on your head, the top of your head burns, you know, so there's no relief. So they point out, we have all these nice places for you. You know, if you don't want to do this, no problem. Don't do it. We don't mind. Yamadutas are always looking for a little entertainment. You know, so here's, you know, nice thing. You have a nice copper plate you can spend, you know, the next 10,000 years on. You know, and then they hear that, and okay, what do I have to do? You know, you just have to, every anniversary of your, you know, of your father, then you have to call this kind of Brahmins that have all these different qualifications and this and that, and not this relative and not that friend and not this one and that one, and drives the guy's nuts trying to find it, and then he finally finds the guy, he's so happy, and then he feeds the Brahmins and all that. So Krishna is happy that he fed the Brahmins, right? Krishna wants to see proper, otherwise he'll just go out on the street, grab three people, sit them down, feed them some slop, and then think, yes, I have done my duty. But, you know, there's 15, 20 pages of how to perform those Shraddha rites just to drive him nuts so that he goes for the thing. And what is the ultimate thing? He's serving Brahmins. And very qualified ones. It says, better to invite one qualified Brahmin and take care of him properly than to invite many and not do properly. So then that one he'll take care of. Then, having taken care of Brahmins, Krishna is pleased. So then his material desire is fulfilled. Then he can go to the heavenly planets or go to Pitri Loka or this or that. But the point is he's following Krishna's, what Krishna wants. Though because he's not thinking of Krishna, has no intent on pleasing Krishna. Therefore, Krishna doesn't give him a spiritual result for pleasing him. Right? He's a materialist. The pious person is pleasing Krishna because he's following Krishna's rules. Right? Though it's indirect. But Krishna is much more satisfied when a relationship is established. We know we're servant of Krishna, and then we do those things for Krishna because they please Krishna. Right? And even if you want to become very grossly materialistic and that and all kinds of nonsense, still Krishna has some rules for that. At least you accept the authority of the Shastra, the Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. At least this principle. Because one day if you become purified, it'll be very natural then for you to, instead of accept scriptures that deal in the mode of ignorance, you'll accept the Bhagavatam. Instead of just accepting, you know, some guru who can teach you, you know, how to perform Kali worship, then you'll accept someone who can teach you how to do proper worship of Krishna. And instead of associating with other very materialistic, you know, persons like this, who are in the guise of sadhus, then you'll associate with bona fide sadhus. Right? But it's natural for you to accept this. Then it's very, very easy. Like that. So that's a nice, that's Krishna's plan. That's his trick. That's why he says there's only one path. Right? Many times we think there's so many paths. There's only one path. You're following Krishna's direction and elevating yourself, maybe very, very slowly, or maybe more quickly, or if you take up devotional service, then the most quick. And if you're not, it means you're breaking all these rules. So that means instead of going towards being elevated, you're being degraded. There's only one path. That's all. You know? That's all it is. You respect others, you're elevated. You respect them because they're part and parcel of Krishna, then one is elevated more. And one doesn't respect others, he's degraded. And if he actually tries to harm others, he's degraded more quickly. So there's only one path. There's not many. There's not a second. There's only Krishna's path. So everything on that path has been delineated by Krishna. So you got hell at one end and Goloka at the other. And everything in between, Krishna has told in the scriptures how to obtain it. So this is the point, is that one tries to please Krishna. So the real piety means when it's in connection with Krishna. And material piety means when it's not in connection with Krishna. So therefore, amongst the transcendentalists, that's not actually considered piety. Right? In other words, following the Dharma Shastra just to be pious is considered adharma by the transcendentalists, because it keeps you in the material world. You know, whether you're bound by a gold chain or an iron chain, it doesn't matter. But now, if you are doing it for Krishna, it elevates us, it purifies us, it frees us from the material contamination. It becomes sat. It becomes itself truth. So that is what is meant by these terms. One understands that, then reading of it is very easy. If not, then one sees all these terms that are natural, attractive words for the materialists. Any questions on all this? No. Yes.
I'm the Shraddha ceremony stops the forefathers from going to hell. Do they then go to Pitriloka? And is the person who's a form Shraddha go to Pitriloka? And what is Pitriloka?
Pitriloka is, from what I understand, is Yamaraja's planet where he lives. Mm-hmm. And then he goes across the Vaitarani River to, you know, his office. You know? And over there, then he sees everybody and all that. So it's like a heavenly planet, you know. So they live nicely, but they're not that high. They're higher than the Gandharvas. Means you have the humans. Then above that is the lower Gandharvas, the Manusha Gandharvas. Then you have above them are the Deva Gandharvas, and above them are the Pitris. But then above the Pitris, then you have the main demigods. Like that, the different levels of the main demigods. So there's something in between the Gandharvas and the demigods in what facilities they get. But it's still a lot more than here. Like that. So then forefathers go there, and then they enjoy there, they're maintained there as long as somebody gives them something to eat. So that's what the shraddhas are for. So in the first year they're performed on the anniversary of that whatever the titi is every month. And then after a year, then it's just done once a year. So you offer a ball of rice. So that ball of rice becomes transformed into enough to feed them for a year. You know, so it's quite a, you know, things work quite well. That's why they're so interested in having sons, because then they'll perform the shraddha ceremonies for them.
like that, because the son is supposed to do it. So they really start freaking out if they only have daughters, you know. Like that. Because the daughter will then go to her husband's house. And so he won't be stay in the father's house. So there's no one in the house to do that. So that's why they get very, they start getting all bent out of shape. So by doing the tarpanas, by doing the shraddha rites, then they're maintained. That's their sustenance. So if one doesn't do it, then it says they'll fall down. Because after a while, you know, if no one feeds you, you start getting hungry. And, you know, you don't have the pious activities to go up, you know, so then you get stuck there. And they get real hungry after a while. And you can imagine someone, like when, if someone's neglected, you know, not fed and all that, they start to become a little weird, you know? No, even, you know, they just, they kind of, they go a little transform, you know? So then, after they've been like this for a long time, no one's taking care of them, and they're just becoming too weird and demented and all that, then Yamaraj is kind upon them, and then he gives them a job. You know what that job is? Yes, the Yamadutas. That's how you become a Yamadut. You're a Petri that no one took care of you for such a long time that then you get a job. And that's why they look like they look like. Imagine, no one took care of you for God only knows how many generations and that, and then they get all that, you know, weird looking and all their hair and wild and all this and that, you know, like that. So that's how they get that. Then they can maintain themselves because they can take part of the offerings, the shraddha offerings that are offered. They get a cut. You know? This way they maintain themselves. So they've got on Pitri Loka because they're religious. That's why the Yamadutas are so, they know what religion is. Therefore they can go around and they know that this person is not religious, and then they can catch him and take him back. You know? And they're very keen on catching irreligious people because that's how they got screwed, you know. They became so hungry is because their family line became irreligious. So they're very happy to get these kind of people. So it's perfect. You know, Krishna gives everybody their spot, you know. And then they get to do all these nice things, you know, roasting people and throwing them off mountains and squeezing them in the sugar cane juicer and, you know, all these kind of like that. So they're very happy because they're in the position they're in because they're irreligious people. So then, like this, it works out very nicely all the way around. Like that. So that's why they're so worried about this. Also, the first one, then that is for if one has gone to hell, it can relieve one from hell. Like that. Mm-hmm. They also, at these times, many times they give umbrellas, shoes, all kinds of things like that. Specific things that they give, like Brahmins who come to these feedings and that, they give these specific items. Because then those go to those forefathers. So when they're walking around, they have shoes, they have an umbrella for the sun. You know, they get the rice and they have things to eat. You give cloth, they have that. Said when the Brahmana, when he, after his bath, for every drop of water that falls off a sika, it rains on Pitri Loka. So when there's, so, you know, just by this preaching movement, then so many Brahmins are created, and so many drops of water are falling from so many sikas. So then these planets are being benefited. So the Sankirtan movement benefits the whole universe. It doesn't just benefit here. The whole universe becomes benefited. That's its power. Like that. So it's how much the Sankirtan movement does actually is not really understood by devotees. You know? So when we chant and all that, that's all taken care of. So we just do that first time. We offer a prasad. And then there, you know, it's devotional service. So from there, you know, then they'll just go to whatever. They've done service, so now they go to the heavenly planets, take birth in aristocratic families like this. So that's they're taken care of. So we don't have to worry about the ongoing year after year shruddhas. Devotees do one time and finish. And then we chant Hare Krishna, and then everything's taken care of. So all the debts we have to the you know, the forefathers, the sages, and all these different, to all the different demigods, it's all taken care of by serving Krishna. Because they're all limbs of Krishna's body, the universal form. So if you please Krishna, then it's already done. Whatever you would have to do indirectly by going through the demigods and the sages and the saints and the Buddhas and all that, here it says here. Let him never, if he is able to perform them, neglect the sacrifices to the sages, to the gods, to the Buddhas, to men, and to the mains. Those five main sacrifices. So, therefore, if one is chanting Hare Krishna, one is serving Krishna, then Krishna is pleased. So then all these personalities, the sages, the gods, the Buddhas, the men, and the mains, are satisfied. They're taken care of. Right? Like that. They're all satisfied. So if we satisfy Krishna, then they're all satisfied. So we don't have to... That is our performance of these things. Mm-hmm. And then there's certain elements that are in there, and all these that are important. That as devotees, these are original devotional activities. But they're also... Because some people are not interested in devotional activities, they have to do it anyway. So then the Krishna works it in so many different ways into these different rites, these things. You know, they must study. They must, you know, feed devotees. You know, they must be kind to all the living entities. They must be considerate of everything. You know, so like that.
So when you mention the forefathers, I never understood this very clearly. It means our ancestors, they are stuck there in the Yamaraj court waiting for judgment, or...
No, it's not a court. It's a planet, and they all live.
So, I mean, any person who dies committing pious or impious activity has to go to that place and just...
No, impious not. It's only pious. Pitri Loka is only for those who are pious.
And the Shraddha ceremony is just for them?
Shraddha ceremony specifically for them, because pious families, then they may be going there. But for the impious families, then it may save them from hell.
But they are already in hell.
No, Pitri Loka is not hell. It's just Yamaraj, it's rather than he comes from the heavenly planets down to his office every day and has to go back, he has basically a heavenly planet down at the bottom of the universe.
They're just they're waiting.
No, they're there. They live there. They stay there. That's their place. Just like someone goes to the moon planet. They live there. That's where they live. It's his planet. Just like Dhruva Loka. Dhruva is the king of that planet. So there's so many devotees are there. So Yamaraj, he has his planet. He's a king there. And then so many devotees. I mean, so many pious people live there. You know? So it's part of the heavenly, you know, facilities. Though it's higher than Gandharvas, but lower than the other demigods that sit with like Indra. And like
so
that.
What's the purpose of the Shraddha then? They're already in heaven.
But you have to maintain them.
Well, just to keep them there.
Yeah. See, that's the thing, is it keeps them there. Well, someone does some big sacrifice or something, like he does a big Ashwamedha Yajna. So that piety from that will keep him in the heavenly planet and maintain him for however long he's supposed to live. And then when that piety runs out, he falls out of the heavenly planet. He's not there anymore. So on Pitri Loka, if the son takes care and then his son and like this, you can just stay there. Because every year they send you 1 year's worth of supplies.
It's a bad luck.
Huh?
It's
still from the materialist, he's looking at it, let's see, one top of the line human unit of happiness, then 100 times that of the Manusha Gandharvas, 100 times that is the Deva Gandharvas, and 100 times that is the Pitris. So 100 times 100 is 10,000. Right? Times 100 is...
A million.
Huh? Yeah. So it's a million times
more happiness than somebody who is the sovereign lord of this planet with no problems. You multiply that for a million, and that's what they're getting there, by getting their little bowl of rice every year. So for the materialist, he's thinking, this is great. You know, but if we continue in this, because this is described in the Taittiriya Upanishad, then 100 times greater than that are the ajana devatas. 100 times that are the other, the regular, the karma devatas. More than that 100 is the regular devatas. You know, like Varuna and all them. Then 100 times that is what Indra, happiness he gets. Then 100 times that is then what Brihaspati gets. 100 times that is what Prajapati gets. 100 times that is what Brahma gets. And what, so that's the top of the line. And then we know that material happiness is like a drop compared to the ocean of happiness of Brahman. It means just of being disconnected from the material world. It means no material attachments or anything. The Brahma-Bhuta platform. Right, and then that is only a fraction of a portion of a drop compared to the unlimited shoreless ocean of the happiness of devotional service. So we know that even though, wow, you look, wow, 1 million times the happiness of, you know, what you can get on this planet, but we know that that's nothing compared to what you get by devotional service. So to them it looks like a great, great thing. But for the devotee, he knows it's not. So it's very, how you say? What is it? You know, probably point out the Hayagriva. When you figure out that what's being offered that looks really good in the material world is not good, he says, that is intelligent. So when one can understand that one goes to Pitri Loka and it's no big deal, that's intelligent. So that's what one is supposed to come to. I mean, someone who's not so intelligent, he thinks it's a great deal and works for it. At least he's being pious. But someone who's more intelligent understands, hey, wait a minute, you know. He means, who wants to get stuck there? We can go back to Godhead. That is then the real intelligence. You know? Like someone who worships Kali. Then before worship of Kali, then you have to, excuse me, not Kali, Kali. Is you have to make all the offerings you want to make to her first to the Shaligram. Right? You have a big fruit plate that has to be offered to Shaligram. Then after that, it can be offered to her. So then the smarter just thinks, okay, that's the rule, and just does it. Someone with intelligence thinks, well, why is it that she will only take that which has been offered to the Shaligram? You know? Because the Shaligram is supposed to be Vishnu, and then she is only taking his remnants. So then after a while, then it dawns on them that, well, she's also known as Vaishnavi, so that must mean that she is also a devotee of Krishna. Then you think, well, if she's a devotee of Krishna, then why we're not seeing her as a devotee, worshipping her in that way, and we also then become devotees of Krishna. So that's the process, as we become intelligent like that. But the slow path may take millions and millions of births. Like I think you mentioned Brahma Samhita, that the jnanis are drilling the respiration, you know. He says for millions of births, and then they still can't see. They just, all they can get is the shine off the toenails of Krishna. And they never actually even see the Lord. Just a little bit of the effulgence off his toenails they can get from a million lifetimes of doing pranayama. So the slow path is real slow. You know, and so in Gita, when Krishna talks about the slow path, he means slow. Because you have to, and this is a million verses of jnani, and you can see the effulgence off of Krishna's toenails. Now how many births did it take as a karmi to get to the platform of jnana? Because jnana, to actually be able to perform it for that many life, means you have to be freed of material contamination. You have to be on the, you know, you have to have elevated yourself. If purified yourself. So how many millions and millions of births there? Then how many births it took that you decided it's better to be pious than impious? So it's such a long path. Such a long path. So Krishna is recommending the short path, which is you just surrender to Krishna. Then you perform the same duties, but now it's for Krishna. And in one lifetime, they purify you and you're out of here. So therefore, it's called the fast. That's the fast path. But that's the intelligence, is when you understand is what's the use of all that? What's the benefit? That is the devotional intelligence that we're trying to develop, once we actually understand it's not one. You know, it's just like you go to the heavenly planets. What do you got? You got a nice garden there called Nandankana. Everybody looks like they're 16 years old, and you know they're really, you know, in good shape. They have, what is it, like Bhakti John? You remember Bhakti John? He said, you know, they got, what is it? Someone's talking about the, you know, some ladies, and that they were, you know, very attractive, and then what is it? Someone's saying, oh, it's just all stool, you know? And he's saying, yeah, but they got all the stool in all the right places. Like that. So there, they have all the stool in all the right places on the heavenly planets. You know, and they have a nice garden and nice things to eat, and everybody's just, you know, they think eternally 16 years old. And then one day they die. I mean, they just, their piety runs out, and that's it, finished.
They fall out, no?
Yeah, they fall out. They don't, no one dies on the heavenly planet. That's the fun part. You imagine you're sitting there with your friend and that, and having a good time, and just suddenly they just disappear. You know, what happened? You know, pious activities ran out. You know, in other words, or you can imagine here. It's like, you know, it's like here. You don't. There's no one really thinks about death, right? And you don't really know when you're going to die and all that. So, on the heavenly planets. The women, they won't get pregnant during their life. Only in the last 1 year of their life they get pregnant. So then you could imagine what anxiety would be there when you found yourself was pregnant. Right? Because then you know, that's it. 1 year. 1 year you're gone. So it's projection of being such a great place, the downside is even more, you know. Because then it's like for 1 year you know you're going to die.
Frightening.
Yeah, it's frightening. You know? And then the combination, you know, the attachment to the child, this and that, but at the same time you know that it's just, you know, this is it, finished. And you're so in anxiety about your sense gratification and all this. And then child is born. Immediately grows up and is 16 years old, right? I mean, heavenly planets, no one plays around with babies, changing diapers. That's, you know, that's not where it's at, right? You know, so that's all for human beings, right? Up there, you're born immediately, you just grow up to be 16 years old, right on the spot. And then he's going, "Hi, Ma, see you later," and out the door. And then you're left there with 2 more months, and then you're dead. You know, you know, son's already gone off enjoying with the girls. And you're sitting there 2 months and you're finished. So it's not necessarily the greatest arrangement. But the Karmakanda section of the Vedas never mentions these points. Never mentions these points. These are all mentioned in the Upanishads and other places like that. Those who are interested in jnana, it tells those things there. And those who are interested in karma, then it only talks nice things, you know, wonderful, great, you know, fabulous. And no one dies there. You live for 10,000 years. I mean, if you put 2 and 2 together, I don't die, but I only live there 10,000 years. So what happens after 10,000 years? But no one thinks, you know. You know, no one thinks.
So great.
Yeah, yeah. But when you get there, then you find out that 10,000 was human years. They didn't say 10,000 years of the demigods. It's 10,000 of our years. Like it says, you go to the moon planet and enjoy for 10,000 years. That's our 10,000 years. Yeah. And the moon planet's 100 years. Lord Brahma only lives 100 years. You know, and according to us, you know what, 311 trillion years. But for him, it's 100. So on the moon planet, they live 10,000 of our years, but it's only 100 to them. Mm-hmm. So it's like the ant, you tell them, hey, you know, somebody lives for what? They live for what, 2 weeks? Right? So that means, you know, one of our years is 25 years to him. You know, so that, so 25 times 100, you know, 2,000, you tell them, yeah, human beings live 2,500 years. He thinks, wow, that's great. But when it comes to human, it's still just 100 years. You know, you live for 2,500 years, no one steps on you. You know? You know, you don't get flooded out every time someone turns on the sink, you know, the tap, like that. And I think, wow, that's great, you know. You know, nobody talked about, you know, the, you know, getting run over by a car, or the airplane crashes, or, you know, the wars and all those things like that. And, you know, you don't have big monstrous birds coming and pecking at you. You know. So it's like that. That's the Krishna's trick to get them to be, you know, at least try to be human. Any other questions?
I have a question from the previous class. You're saying about studying the different times of the days. About two or three classes ago, you said in the morning, like memory, things connected to memory, like learning mantras and so on and stuff. Middle of the day, private study, in the evening, philosophical discussion and so on.
Hmm.
Was there any particular reason why it was put into that order, that that organization is there?
With the early morning, the mind is very fresh. And then as the day progresses, the mode of passion becomes prominent. So then the things that are more active and all that, or arts and that, become very... It's easy to study them and deal with them, or active activities. Then, you know, after lunch, then everything slows down a bit again. You know, so it's a good time also for one's own study or hearing stories and this. And then the evening, then the atmosphere takes on again a very nice, you know, peacefulness for spiritual, you know, strong spiritual activities. Then it's a very good time for classes and that. See, in the morning it's light, but in the evening it's dark. So then generally philosophical discussion, you know, that, bhajans, these kind of things are followed. Because to do other studies, you need to be able to, you know, you need to be able to read, or you're hearing, but it's, you'll be into more technical. Well, in the evening, then it'll be less technical. You know, like at this time, you wouldn't want to be studying, let's say, Sanskrit or astrology or the technicalities of Ayurveda. But the philosophy of the Ayurveda or these things, so, you know, you can hear and assimilate. The other ones, you have to be able to sit and analyze them and all that, so that the brain is good at that in the morning. Okay, that's all.
Another question was in the same class, just about psychology. You were saying about, like, girls and boys, when they're younger, saying how girls are naturally tidy and boys are always messy. Is there any... Where you can explain how that's happening. And that you generally always see that. I'm just wondering why.
Well, girls mature quicker. Mm-hmm. A girl is a woman at 12. But a boy is not a man until, you know, 18, 19, 20, unless some circumstance forces it. But on their own, they'll just waste their time until that age. You know, the Vedic culture generally, like Prabhupada mentions, 5 to 25. he's expecting it's going to take for the full maturation of the boy up until the age of 25. Like that. You know? But the girl is already matured way before that. Mm-hmm. It's just, so you see girls when they're like 9 years old, 10 years old, they can chant 16 rounds, follow sadhana, and that all very nicely. But the boys are still just playing. Like that. Because point is they have to be able to hold down a house. They have to be able to raise children. Right? So they have to learn very seriously all these kind of things very quickly. So just it's just the way their brain works, yeah. Anything else? Time is enough. Okay, so then we'll end here then.